This podcast is brought to you by the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. The advent of AI, artificial intelligence, is leading to deeper conversations about the influence this technology will have in the years ahead. And as in several areas of our culture, there are ethical questions being asked about AI's impact on our lives in the future. Timne Gebru is a research scientist with Google's artificial intelligence team. She is speaking today here at the University of Pennsylvania, more specifically here at the Wharton School, to take a look at how the history of collecting sociocultural data will influence AI. But she is also joining us here in the studio for a little while. Nice to meet you. Welcome to Philadelphia.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. With so many concerns about kind of the collection of data already right now, what are you most concerned about the process that we will see probably play out as AI continues to be a bigger piece of what we deal with on a daily basis?
I think the thing I have been most concerned about is the quote-unquote move fast and break things attitude. And with my talk and with my research, that's one of the things I'm trying to change, right? So when you have software and when you have like all of these tools that are available for people that you can just download really quickly and collect data really quickly and kind of put it out there quickly, you tend to not think about certain things, right, that you should think about. And so we need to have incentive structures out there to slow down a little bit and educate people on what kind of things they should think about when they're collecting data.
So what do you think then we need to put in place to actually get to that point?
I think it's a combination of things. So it was interesting that you were talking about Intel because I used to work in the hardware industry. And one of my papers that I wrote, it's called Data Sheets for Datasets. And that's talking about instituting process that exists in hardware. And hardware, it's very difficult to move fast and break things. You have to move very slowly and don't break anything, right? Because when you break something, it costs you a lot of money. And so instituting that kind of process internally inside of companies and also regulation, but I mean, that's a different conversation. But I think there need to be international standardization bodies. There needs to be a bigger process in companies. There needs to be an understanding of institutionalization of process and kind of rewarding people who follow those kinds of processes.
So when you're talking about ethics and AI and that point of intersection, are the parties all involved, the companies, the people with the firms, are they truly aware of some of these issues that are out there, and are they prepared to address them?
I don't know if people are truly aware. Like, for example, I just learned about a company called Clearview AI like yesterday from a New York Times article. And this was the kind of, I'm not sure if you've heard about it. It was this like little company that's scraping lots and lots of billions of photos from Facebook. And they can, law enforcement is using it to identify suspects, right? Yep. And it's not just a database of criminals that they're using now. It's a database of just anybody. And so the fear is that they can just use that privacy, as we know, it would be over, that you could just walk down the street one day and they can take a picture of you and that's what's going to happen, right? I didn't know this company existed. I mean, I knew that this possibility existed, but I didn't know this company existed. So one of the things that's happening is some of your prior guests said that technology innovation is outpacing regulation and policy, right? And so all of these little things are popping up that we didn't know about. And so I don't think everyone is aware. I think that, for example, one of my papers with Joy Balamini showed that there were high disparities in error rates across different groups of people for for automated facial analysis tools, right? That paper just came out in 2018.
Right.
And we showed for the first time that how high the disparities in error rates were between darker skinned women and especially lighter skinned men. And that spurred a lot of activity, like that spurred a lot of changes in industry and policy. And so that's the fastest that I've seen from learning about something to policy. But there are many such problems that people are not aware of.
So
I think.
Then do you think, is it fair then to call it this, what we're going to move into in the next few years with AI more and more of an impact on our lives? Is this kind of a revolution that we're going to be going through with obviously what we're going to be seeing firsthand, but as you just alluded to, a lot of the changes that are going to need to occur in company structure, in policy, in regulation?
I hope it will be a revolution. I don't know if it will be a revolution, but I do know, like, this last year and this year, there's been a lot more activity on this area, a lot more conversations than when I first started working on this kind of topic, where it was very difficult for me to even explain to people why it's important to think about these things. And I also realize, I've been noticing that this year, there's much more conversation about the intersection of labor rights, people working in low wages, annotating images or something like this for AI. And that intersection of that with ethics as well. And so it's probably fair to call it a revolution. I'm not sure. I hope it will be, but yeah.
So then how do you think, then, using your company as an example at Google, how has that intersection starting to develop? Or, you know, are you seeing some of the changes occur in the daily operations of Google?
Yeah, I have seen some changes. So, for example, some of the things I wrote about in some of my papers, we're trying to institute. You know, it's hard to steer a big ship, right? We're a small research team trying to change things. But one example I want to give you is that it's basically unheard of to have an interdisciplinary research team at Google, right? Like, it's all the interviews are about coding and some other things. And so we just had the first social scientist to be a research scientist at Google, writing a paper about critical race theory and how that should, you know, be there should be a fairness of literature. So ethics and fairness literature should take a look at critical race theory and things like that. And that's kind of unheard of, right? So I think it's important to have that type of thinking, those kinds of other disciplines injected into the tech industry right now.
Yeah.
So this is just one example I'm giving you. And of course, there was, I think Sundar just came out saying that he supports a ban on face recognition. So these are changes that have happened relatively quickly, I would say, in the last couple of years. But there's, of course, a long way to go.
But I think the other interesting piece to this is, and you alluded to it a moment ago, is there are so many different areas where this type of data and this type of process are being tested out or being looked at right now. There was one that was highlighted in an article that you were a part of in the New York Times about looking at the type of people that are going to vote, Republican voters, and the types of cars that they drive. And you would think, you know, why would you want to know that? But there are various reasons for wanting to even know that type of information.
You know, what's interesting is that was part of my PhD project. And some of my subsequent work is actually motivated by that. Because when I was working on that project, so I'm still working on some kinds of research like that, I think, which would be helpful, for example, in the developing world where you don't have a lot of money to perform census and things like that. But you have publicly available satellite imagery, and you can learn some things that would help for policy and that would help you understand certain things. But then it could also be used in ways that are just not great at all. So some of the places, people who are very interested in that line of work were banks and insurance companies. And then there was a subsequent paper that came out that talked about how, I don't know if you looked at, heard about this, they claimed to be able to predict your rate of car accidents? I forget now. Based on your house, like how your house looks on Street View, right? And the article started, first a group of, you know, Stanford researchers showed this kind of thing with cars, and now follow-up work. And I'm like, oh, but this is not what I want.
Well, just what you said there a second ago about the potential impact on something like the census.
Yeah.
I mean, the census has been obviously this traditional element that we have here in the United States every 10 years. We're obviously, you know, in the process of going through it right now. But when you think about other countries, to be able to truly understand how many people live in a country, what the rate of migration might be in a particular part of the world, that's all very important information to be able to have a better understanding on.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, when I was working on this project, to be honest with you, I didn't know how contentious the census was and how political it was. And I talked to Dana Boyd from Data and Society, who was also at Microsoft Research, and she is an expert on the census. And so, for example, we were talking about how different groups of people can be undercounted because they're too scared to answer survey questions on the census, right? Mm-hmm. So one thing I was thinking about is how can you complement this door-to-door kind of thing with using publicly available data, right? Like to see if there is severe undercounting in some areas than others. And this is the kind of use that I would be excited about, even in the United States. But like with everything, there are so many other ways in which, you know, this kind of work can be used. And I started thinking more and more about it after I was done working on the project.
One of the other areas I know that you're very passionate about is diversity. And I wanted to touch on that for a moment. And if you can, give us what you think is kind of the state of diversity in the tech sector, because obviously that's been a story that has been talked about a lot in the last few years. And the hope is that it maybe is incrementally improving a little bit.
So the overall state is not very good. I'm just going to say it's just not good. And one of the, so Rachel Thomas is someone I really admire, and she writes just so clearly about some of these topics. And one thing she wrote was how diversity branding hurts diversity, which means a lot of corporations and institutes talk so much about diversity. And so you think that there's a lot going on, right? And that hurts actual diversity because it also creates a backlash. One of my colleagues was actually doxxed on Twitter for working on the kinds of things we do, and because it creates the kind of backlash that it does, right? So I don't like all so much of the talk about diversity. I don't know if it's getting better, but in some ways, one positive thing I can talk about is, you know, we started a group called Black and AI with my co-founder, Reddy Tapaba, and we poured our heart and soul into it, right? And we did a lot of other work. And so this conference called NeurIPS, which is one of the, I think, the largest academic machine learning AI, basically, conference. And when I went there in 2016, there was about 5,500 people, I believe, and I counted like 5 black people internationally, right? So it's an international conference. So internationally, black people, however you count it, let's say the U.S.-based kind of race, it's about 20%, right? Like, you know, so 5 out of 5,500 is... So after all of this work, right, like all the work we did, we increased the presence to, let's say, like 300-400 out of like 15,000. So it's like 400-500 out of 15,000. So now when I went back to that conference, I felt a lot more. I mean, it's still, by the way, that's a really low number.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But all of that work got us from 5 to 500. That's a really low number, but it makes a huge difference because you see when people go there, they don't feel so as isolated as before. It makes a huge difference, even if it's a small number. And so when I went to this conference again, it was actually the most inclusive conference I had been to. Like, there were different groups called Disabilities in AI, advocating for people in disabilities, accessibility, making sure people with disabilities are taken care of and you know, their needs are taken care of, right? Because there's a lot of practices that are not good for them. Queer in AI, Latinx in AI, and there's all sorts of stuff that was going on. And then the conference itself changed some of its, you know, structure to accommodate these things. And so that's a great change because now, you know, I want to go back to that conference again. Many times your experiences at these conferences will make or break whether you want to be in a particular field. Because if you feel super isolated, you don't feel welcome, you'll just be like, I don't think this is for me. I'm going to do something else.
Great meeting you. Thank you for coming in today.
Thank you.
Have fun with the conference and the speech today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Timnit Gebru with Google's artificial intelligence team.
To keep engaged with Wharton Business Daily and other Wharton School shows, visit businessradio.wharton.upenn.edu.